books between them, a shared memory. She could hear the ocean pounding in the distance. She could see the green wall of water rising behind her eyelids in her dream. But it all seemed distant, the terrifying crash of waves drowned out by the soft breathing of her parabatai. One day she and Julian would both be married, to other people. There would be no crawling into each other's beds. There would be no exchanging of secrets at midnight. Their closeness wouldn't break, but it would bend and stretch into a new shape. She would have to learn to live with that. One day, but not quite yet. When Emma woke, Julian was gone. She sat up groggily. It was mid-morning, later than she usually rose, and the room was lit with a pinkish-gold tinge. Julian's navy blue sheets and blanket were tangled down at the foot of the bed. When Emma put her hand against his pillow, it was still warm. He must have just left. She pushed down her feeling of uneasiness that he'd gone without saying anything. He probably just hadn't wanted to wake her. Julian had always been an uneasy sleeper, and the time difference couldn't be helping. Telling herself it was no big deal, she went back to her room and changed into leggings and a t-shirt and slid her feet into flip-flops. Normally she would have checked Julian's studio first, but she could see from a glance out the window that it was a bright, brilliant summer day. The sky was filled with the light brushstrokes of white cloud. The sea glimmered, the surface dancing with flecks of gold. In the distance, Emma could see the black dots of surfers bobbing on the surface. She knew he'd missed the ocean, knew it from the few brief, infrequent texts and fire messages he'd sent her while he was in England. She made her way through the institute and down the path that led to the highway, then darted across it, dodging surfers' vans and luxury convertibles on their way to Nobu. He was exactly where she thought he'd be when she reached the beach, facing the water and the sun, the salt air lifting his hair and rippling the cloth of his t-shirt. She wondered how long he'd been standing there, hands in the pockets of his jeans. She took a hesitant step onto the damp sand. "Jules?" He turned to look at her. For a moment he looked dazzled, as if he were looking into the sun, though it was above them. Emma could feel its warmth, bright and hot on her back. He smiled. A wave of relief went through her. It was Julian's familiar smile, the one that lit up his face. She jogged down to the waterline. The tide was coming in, sliding up the beach to reach the tips of Julian's shoes. "You woke up early," she said, splashing through the shallows toward him. The water made silvery inroads into the sand. "It's almost noon," he said. His voice sounded ordinary, but he still looked different to Emma, strangely different. The shape of his face, his shoulders under his t-shirt. "What did you want to talk to me about?" "What?" Emma was caught temporarily off guard, both by the difference in him and the sudden question. "Last night," he said. "You said you wanted to talk to me. How about now?"
"Okay." Emma looked up at the gulls wheeling overhead. "Let's go sit down. I don't want to get washed away when the tide comes in."
They settled in farther up the beach, where the sand was warm from the sunlight. Emma kicked her shoes off to dig her toes in, exulting in the grainy feeling. Julian laughed. She looked at him sideways.
"What is it?"
"You and the beach," he said. "You love the sand, but you hate the water."
"I know," she said, widening her eyes at him. "Isn't it ironic?"
"It's not ironic. Irony is the unexpected outcome of an expected situation. This is just one of your quirks."
"You shock me," Emma said, pulling out her phone. "I am shocked."
"Sarcasm noted," he said, turning the phone over in his right hand. Christina's photos from the previous night had loaded. As he ran his eyes over them, she explained how she'd followed the tip from Johnny Rook to the sepulchre, the way she'd found the body, and Diana scolding following Rook's visit to the Institute. As she spoke, she relaxed, her odd new awareness of Julian fading. This was normal. This was them the way they always were, talking, listening, working as parabatai.
"I know these are the same markings," she finished. "I'm not out of my mind, am I?"
Julian looked up at her.
"No,"
he said. "But Diana thinks that if you look into this, it'll compromise the Clave's willingness to let Helen come home?"
"Yeah."
Emma hesitated, then reached out and took his hand. The sea glass bracelet on his left wrist clinked musically. She felt his calluses against her fingers, as familiar to her as a map of her own bedroom. I would never do anything to hurt Helen or Mark or you, she said. If you think Diana's right, I won't. She swallowed. I'll leave it alone. Julian glanced down at their entwined fingers. He was still, but a pulse had started up at the base of his throat. She could see it beating, hard. It must have been the mention of his sister. It's been 5 years, he said, and drew his hand back. He didn't yank it out of her grip or anything like that, just drew it back as he turned toward the water. A completely natural movement that nevertheless left her feeling awkward. The Clave hasn't budged on letting Helen come home. They haven't budged on looking for Mark, and they haven't budged on considering that maybe your parents weren't killed by Sebastian either. It seems wrong to sacrifice finding out what happened to your family for a doomed hope. Don't say it's doomed, Jules. There's another way of thinking about this, too, he said. She could practically see the gears turning in his quick brain. If you actually solved this, if we solved this, the Clave would owe us. I believe you that whoever killed your parents, it wasn't Sebastian Morgenstern. We're looking at a demon or some other force that has the power to murder shadow hunters and get away with it, if we defeated something like that. Emma's head was starting to ache. Her ponytail holder was twisted hard into her hair. She reached up to loosen it. Then they'd give us special treatment, you mean? Because everyone would be watching? They'd have to, Julian said. If everyone knew what we did. And we could make sure everyone knew, he hesitated. We do have connections. You don't mean Jem, do you? Asked Emma. Because I don't know how to reach him. Not Jem and Tessa. So Jason Clary, Emma said. Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild ran the New York Institute. They were some of the youngest shadow hunters ever to hold such a senior position. Emma had been friends with Clary since she was 12, when Clary had first followed her out of the council hall in Idris, the only person among all the Clave, it seemed, to care that she had lost her parents. Jace was probably one of the best shadow hunters who had ever lived, purely in terms of fighting prowess. Clary had been born with a different talent. She could create runes. It was something no other shadow hunter had ever been able to do. She had explained once to Emma that she couldn't force the runes that came to her. Either they did or they didn't. Over the years, she'd added several useful runes to the Grey Book, one for breathing underwater, another for running long distances, and a rather controversial one for birth control that had nevertheless quickly become the most often used rune in the lexicon. Everyone knew Jace and Clary. That was how it went when you saved the world. They were heroes to most. To Emma, they were people who had held her hands during the darkest part of her life. Yeah. Julian reached around, rubbed the back of his neck. He looked tired. There was a faint sheen to the skin under his eyes, as if it was stretched thin with exhaustion. He worried at his lip with his teeth, as he always did when he was anxious or bothered. I mean, they were made some of the youngest heads of an institute ever. And look at what the Clave did for Simon and for Magnus and Alec. When you're a hero, they'll do a lot for you. Julian stood up, and Emma rose with him, pulling the band out of her ponytail. Her hair came free, tumbling in waves down her shoulders and her back. Julian looked at her quickly and then away. Jules, she began. But he had already turned away, heading back toward the road. She shoved her feet into her shoes and caught up with him where the sand rose up toward the pavement. Is everything okay? Of course. Here, sorry. I forgot to give you this back. He handed Emma her phone. Look, the Clave makes their rules, and they live by their rules. But that doesn't mean that with the right pressure, the rules never change. You're being cryptic. He smiled, the corners of his eyes crinkling. They don't like letting shadow hunters as young as we are get involved in serious issues. Never have. But Jason Clary and Alec and Isabel saved the world when they were our age. They were honored for it. Results. That's what makes them change their minds. They had reached the highway. Emma looked up toward the hills. The institute was perched on a low bluff over the coast road. Julian Blackthorne, she said as they crossed the highway. You revolutionary, you. So we'll look into this, but do it quietly, Julian said. First move, compare the photos of the body you found to the photos of the bodies of your parents. Everyone will want to help. Don't worry. They were halfway up the Institute Road. Cars were backed up even now, mundanes commuting to work downtown. Sunlight sparked off their windshields. And if it turns out the markings are just gibberish and it's some random lunatic on a murder spree? Couldn't be a spree. Sprees happen all at once, but in different locations. Like if you drive from place to place shooting people, that's a spree. So what's this, a mass murder? Mass murders also all take place at the same time, but are in the same location, Julian said loftily in the same tone he used when explaining to Tavi why he couldn't have Cheerios for breakfast. This is definitely a serial killer. That's when the murders are spaced out over time. It's disturbing that you know this, Emma said. In front of the Institute, stretching to the edge of the bluff, was a sun-dried lawn, edged with seagrass and scrub brush. The family spent little time there, too close to the highway, unshaded and overlaid with scratchy grass.
Drew's into true crime right now, Joel said. They'd reached the Institute stairs. You wouldn't believe how much he told me about how to hide a body.
Emma sprang past him up three steps, turned to look down. I'm taller than you, she announced. It was a game they'd played when they were little. Emma always swearing she'd grow up taller than he was, finally giving up when he turned 14 and shot up 5 inches. Julian looked up at her. The sun was shining directly into his eyes, overlaying the blue-green with gold, making them look like the patina that shone on the Roman glass Arthur collected. Em, he said, however much we might joke about it, you know I take this seriously. It's your parents. You deserve to know what happened. She felt a sudden lump in her throat. This just feels different, she whispered. I know how many times I've thought I found out something and it was nothing, or I followed a false lead, but this feels like something else, Jules. This feels real. Her phone rang. She looked away from Jules, fishing it out of her pocket. When she saw the name flash up on screen, she made a face and shoved it back. Jules raised an eyebrow, his expression neutral.
Cameron Ashdown, he said. Why aren't you picking up?
Just not in the mood.
The words came out almost to her surprise. She wondered why she wasn't telling him.
Cameron and I broke up.
The front door banged open.
Emma! Jules!
It was Drusilla and Tavi, both still in pajamas.
Tavi had a lollipop in one hand and was sucking on it industriously. When he saw Emma, his eyes lit up and he ran toward her. Emma! He said around the candy.
She pulled him close and wrapped her arms around his round little boy middle, squeezing until he giggled.
Tavi, Julian said, don't run with lollipops in your mouth. You could choke.
Tavi removed the lollipop and stared at it the way someone might stare at a loaded gun.
And die?
Hideously, Julian said. Fatally, fatally die. He turned to Drusilla, who had her hands on her hips. Her black pajamas were decorated with cartoon drawings of chainsaws and skeletons. What's up, Drew?
It's Friday, Drusilla said. Pancake day, you remember? You promised.
Oh, right, I did.
Julian tugged affectionately on one of his little sister's braids. You go wake up Livy and Ty, and I'll...
They're already awake, Drew said.
They're in the kitchen,
waiting.
She looked at him pointedly.
Julian smiled.
Okay, I'll be right there.
He picked Tavi up and deposited him back in the entryway. You two scoot along to the kitchen and reassure the twins before they get desperate and start trying to do the cooking themselves. They scampered off, giggling. Julian turned back to Emma with a sigh.
I have been lollipopped, he said, indicating where Tavi had managed to leave a blue sugar circle at the collar of his shirt.
Badge of honor, Emma laughed.
See you in the kitchen. I need to shower.
She darted up the steps, pausing at the open front door to look down at him. Framed against the blue sea and blue sky, his eyes looked like bits of the landscape.
Jules, was there something you wanted to ask me?
He glanced away, shaking his head.
No, nothing at all.
Someone was shaking Christina by the shoulder. She woke up slowly, blinking. She'd been dreaming about home, about the heat of summer, the shade of the cool gardens of the Institute, the roses her mother cultivated in a climate not always friendly to the delicate flower. Yellow roses were preferred, because he had been the favorite flower of her most beloved writer, but roses of any color were necessary to eliminate the proud name of Rosales. Christina had been walking in a garden, about to turn a corner, when she heard the murmur of familiar voices. She sped up, a smile spreading over her face. Jaime and Diego, her oldest friend and her first love. Surely they would be happy to see her. She swung around the corner and stared, but there was no one there. Just the echo of voices, the distant sound of a mocking laugh carried on the wind. The shade and petals faded away, and Christina looked up to find Emma leaning over her, wearing one of her crazy flower dresses. Her hair hung down around her shoulders in strands damp from the shower.
Deja de molestarme, estoy despierta,
protested Christina, battling Emma's hands away.
Emma, stop it, I'm awake.
She sat up and put her hands to her head. She prided herself on not ever mixing up her first language with English while she was in the U.S., but sometimes when she was tired or barely awake, it slipped out.
Come with me to breakfast, Emma wheedled.
Or it might be brunch.
It's almost noon. But whatever, I want to introduce you to everyone. I want you to meet Julian.
I saw him last night from the top of the stairs, said Christina with a yawn. He has nice hands.
Great, you can tell him that in person.
No, thank you.
Get up, Emma said, or I'll sit on you.
Christina threw a pillow at her. Go wait outside. A few minutes later, Christina, having dressed quickly in a pale pink sweater and pencil skirt, found herself being marched down the hall. She could hear voices raised in chatter coming from the kitchen. She touched the medallion at her throat, the way she always did when she needed a bit of extra bravery. She'd heard so much about the Blackthorns, especially Julian since she'd arrived at the Institute, that they'd taken on an almost mythical status in her mind. She was dreading meeting them, and not only were they the most important people in Emma's life, but they were also the ones who could make the rest of her stay either pleasant or miserable. The kitchen was a large room with painted walls and windows looking out over the blue-green ocean in the distance. A massive farmer's table dominated the space, surrounded by bench seats and chairs. The counters and table were tiled in what looked like bright Spanish designs, but if you glanced more closely, they formed scenes from classical literature. Jason and the Argonauts, Achilles and Patroclus, Odysseus and the Sirens. Someone once had decorated this space with a loving hand. Someone had picked out the copper cooking range, the porcelain double sinks, the exact shade of yellow on the walls. Julian was standing over the stove, barefoot, a dish towel slung around his broad shoulders. The younger Blackthorns were crowded around the table. Emma came forward, pulling Christina behind her.
Everyone, this is Christina, she said.
She saved my life about 16 times this summer, so be nice to her. Christina, this is Julian. Julian looked over and smiled. The smile made him look like sunlight in human form. It didn't hurt that the dish towel around his neck had kittens on it, and there was pancake batter on his calloused hands. Thanks for not letting Emma get killed, he said. Contrary to whatever she might have told you, we need her around here. I'm Livy, the pretty girl who was one half of the twins came forward to shake Christina's hand. And that's Ty. She pointed to a boy with black hair who was curled up on a bench seat reading the casebook of Sherlock Holmes. Drew has the braids, and Tavi is the one with the lollipop.
Don't run with the lollipop, Christina, said Tavi.
He looked around seven with a thin, serious face. I won't, Christina assured him, puzzled.
Tavi,
Julian groaned. He was pouring batter from a white ceramic pitcher into the frying pan on the stove, the room filled with the smell of butter and pancakes. Get up and set the table, you useless layabouts. Not you, Christina, he added, looking embarrassed. You're a guest. I'll be here for a year. I'm not really a guest, Christina said, and went with the rest of them to get cutlery and plates. There was a buzz of pleasant activity, and Christina felt herself relax. If she had to admit it, she'd been dreading the Blackthorns descending, disrupting the pleasant rhythm of her life here with Emma and Diana. Now that the family was here, here and real, she felt guilty for having resented them. First pancakes are up, Julian announced. Ty put down his book and picked up a plate. Christina, reaching into the refrigerator for more butter, heard him say to Julian, I thought you forgot it was pancake day. There was accusation in his voice and something else besides, a slight edge of nervousness. She remembered Emma saying in passing that Ty got upset when his routine was interrupted.
I didn't forget, Ty, Julian said gently. I was distracted, but I didn't forget.
Ty seemed to relax.
All right.
He went back over to the table, and Tavi bounded up after him. They were organized, the Blackthorns, in the unconscious way that only a family could be, knowing who got pancakes first, Ty, who wanted butter and syrup, Drew, who wanted just syrup, Livy, and who wanted sugar, Emma. Christina ate hers plain. It was buttery and not too sweet, crisp around the edges. "These are good," she said to Julian, who had finally sat down on a bench seat beside Emma. Up close she could see lines of tiredness at the edges of his eyes, lines that seemed out of place on the face of a boy so young.
"Practice," he smiled at her. "I've been making them since I was 12.
Livy gave a bounce in her seat. She was wearing a black tank dress and reminded Christina of the stylish mundane girls in Mexico City, striding purposefully around Condesa and Roma in their sheathed dresses and delicate strappy heels. Her brown hair was streaked liberally with gold where the sun had bleached it.
"It's so good to be back," she said, licking syrup off her finger. "It just wasn't the same at Great Aunt Marjorie's without you two looking after us." She pointed at Emma and Julian. "I see why they say you shouldn't separate, Parabatai. You just go together, like..."
"Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson," said Ty, who had gone back to reading.
"Chocolate and peanut butter," said Tavi.
"Captain Ahab and the Whale," said Drew, who was dreamily drawing patterns in the syrup on her empty plate.
Emma choked on her juice. "Drew, the Whale and Captain Ahab were enemies."
"True," Julian agreed. "The Whale without Ahab is just a whale. A whale with no problems. A stress-free whale." Drew looked mutinous.
"I heard you guys talking," she said to Emma and Julian. "I was out on the lawn before I went back to get Tavi about Emma finding a body."
Ty looked up immediately. "Emma found a body?" Emma glanced a little worriedly at Tavi, but he appeared absorbed in his food.
She said, "Well, while you guys were gone, there have been a series of murders."
"Murders? How come you didn't say anything to Julian or us about it?" Ty was bolt upright now, his book dangling from his hand. "You could have sent an email or a fire message or a postcard."
"A murder postcard?" said Livy, wrinkling up her nose.
"I only found out about it the night before last," Emma said, and explained quickly what had happened at the sepulchre. "The body was covered in runes," she finished. "The same kind of markings that were on my parents' bodies when they were found."
"No one's ever been able to translate those, right?" Livy said.
"No one," Emma shook her head. "Everyone's tried to decode them. Malcolm, Diana, even the Spiral Labyrinth," she added, naming the underground headquarters of the world's warlocks, where a great deal of arcane knowledge was hidden.
"Before they were unique as far as we knew," Ty said.
His eyes were really a very startling gray, like the back of a silver spoon. A pair of headphones hung around his neck, the cord snaking down his shirt.
"Now there's another example. If we compare them, we might learn something."
"I made a list of everything I know about the body," Emma said, producing a piece of paper and setting it on the table.
Ty picked it up immediately.
"Some is what I saw, some I heard from Johnny Rook and Diana. The fingertips were sanded down, teeth broken, wallet missing."
"Someone trying to hide the identity of the victim," said Ty.
"And probably not that uncommon," said Emma.
"But there was also the fact that the body was soaked in seawater and showed signs of burning and was lying in a chalked ring of symbols and was covered in writing. That seems unusual."
"Like the sort of thing you could search for in back archives of mundane newspaper articles," said Ty. His gray eyes glowed with excitement. "I'll do it."
"Thank you," Emma said, but..."
She glanced toward Julian and then around at the others, her brown eyes grave.
"Diana can't know, okay?"
"Why not?" asked Drew, frowning.
Tavi was paying no attention at all. He'd gotten down on the floor and was playing under the table with a set of toy trucks.
Emma sighed.
"Several of the dead bodies were Fey, and that puts us squarely out of any territory we should be messing with." She glanced over at Christina. "If you don't want to do any of this, that's fine. Fairy business is tricky, and Diana doesn't want us involved."
"You know how I feel about the cold piece," said Christina. "Absolutely, I will help."
There was a murmur of agreement.
"Told you not to worry," said Julian, touching Emma's shoulder lightly before standing up to start clearing the breakfast dishes.
There was something about that touch, light and casual as it was, it sent a jolt through Christina.
"You've got today off from classes. Diana's gone up to Ojai, so now's a good time for us to do this, especially since we've got clave testing this weekend."
There was a collective groan. Clave testing was a twice-yearly chore in which students were evaluated to see if their skills were up to par, or if they needed to be sent to the academy in Idris. But Ty ignored Julian's announcement. He was looking at Emma's paper. How many have died exactly? People and fairies.
12, said Emma. 12 dead bodies.
Tavi emerged from under the table.
Were they all running with lollipops?
Ty looked baffled. Emma, guilty. Tavi, slightly lip-wobbly. Maybe that's enough for now, Julian said, scooping up his smallest brother.
Let's see what you find out, Tiberius.
Livia? Ty murmured assent, rising to his feet.
Emma said, Christine and I were going to practice, but we can—
No, don't cancel it,
Livia bounced upright. I need to practice, with another girl who isn't reading, she said, shooting a glare at Drew. We're watching a horror movie. She glanced over at her twin. I'll help Ty for half an hour, she said, then I'll come to train. He nodded and slipped his headphones on, making his way toward the door. Livy went with him, chattering about how much she'd missed training and her saber and about how their great-aunt's idea of a training room was her barn, which was full of spiders. Christina glanced back as she left the kitchen. The room was full of bright light, and it cast an odd halo over Emma and Julian, blurring out their features. Julian was holding Tavi, and as Emma leaned in, they made up an odd family picture. You don't have to do this for me, Emma was saying softly but earnestly in a voice Christina had never heard her use before. I think I do, Julian said. I think I remember making a vow to that effect. Whither thou goest, I will go. Whatever stupid thing you do, I shall do also, Emma said. Was that the vow? Julian laughed. If there were more words between the two, Christina didn't hear them spoken. She let the door close behind her without looking back again. She had once thought she would have a parabatai herself, though it was a dream she had long put to bed. There was something about that sort of intimacy that was painful to overhear. 4. And this was the reason. Emma hit the training mat hard, rolling quickly so that Cortana, still strapped to her back, wouldn't be damaged, or damage her. In the early years of her training, she'd inflicted more injuries on herself by accident with Cortana's sharp edges than any exercises had, thanks to her stubborn refusal to take it off. Cortana was hers, her father's, and her father's father's. She and Cortana were what was left of the Carstairs family. She never left the blade behind when she went to fight, even if they planned to use daggers or holy water or fire. Therefore, she needed to know how to fight with it strapped to her in every conceivable circumstance. Are you all right? Christina hit the mat beside her more lightly. She wasn't armed and was wearing only her training clothes. Christina had sense, Emma thought, sitting up and rubbing her sore shoulder. Fine. Emma stood up, shaking out the kinks in her muscles. One more time. The metal around Christina's throat gleamed decorously as she craned her head back, watching Emma shinny back up the rope ladder. Dark gold sunlight was pouring through the windows. It was late afternoon. They'd been training for hours, and before that they'd been busy bringing the contents of Emma's wall of proof, Christina refused to call it a wall of crazy, into the computer room so Livy and Ty could scan it all. Livy was still promising to come train with them, though she had clearly been absorbed into the online search for clues. You can stop there, Christina called when Emma was halfway up, but Emma ignored her and kept going until her head was nearly bumping the ceiling. Emma looked down. Christina was shaking her head, managing to look both composed and disapproving at the same time. You can't jump from such a height, Emma! Emma let go and dropped like a stone. She hit the mat, rolled, and sprang up into a crouch, reaching back over her shoulder for Cortana. Her hand closed on empty air. She shot upright, only to find Christina holding the blade. She'd slipped it from Emma's scabbard as she was rising to her feet. There is more to fighting than jumping the highest and falling the farthest, Christina said, and held Cortana out to her. Emma rose and took the blade back with a grudging smile. You sound like Jules. Maybe he has a point, Christina said. Have you always been this careless about your safety? More since the Dark War. Emma slipped Cortana back into its scabbard. She drew the stiletto blades from her boots and handed one to Christina before turning to face the target painted on the opposite wall. Christina moved to Emma's side and raised the blade in her hand, sighting down along the line of her arm. Emma hadn't thrown knives with Christina before, but she was unsurprised to see that Christina's posture and grip on the knife, her thumb parallel to the blade, were perfect. Sometimes I regret that I knew little of the war. I was in hiding in Mexico,
My Uncle Tomas was convinced Idris would not be safe. Emma thought of Idris burning, of the blood in the streets, bodies stacked like kindling in the Accords Hall.
Your uncle was right.
He died in the war, so I suppose he was. Christina released her blade. It flew through the air and thumped into the central ring of the target. My mother owned a house in San Miguel de Allende. We went there because the Institute was not safe. I always feel a coward when I think about it.
You were a kid, Emma said. They were right to send you where you would be safe.
Maybe, said Christina, looking downcast.
Really, I'm not just saying that, Emma told her.
I mean, how does Perfect Diego feel about that? Does he feel like a coward?
Christina made a face. I doubt it.
Of course not. He's totally well-adjusted about everything.
We should all be more like Perfect Diego.
Hello?
A greeting rang through the room. It was Livy, in practice gear, heading toward them. She paused to pet her saber, which was hanging on the wall near the door with the other fencing swords. Livy had chosen the saber for her weapon when she was about 12 years old, and had practiced tenaciously ever since. She could discourse on types of saber, wooden grips versus rubber or leather ones, tangs and pommels, and it was better not to get her started on pistol grips. Emma admired her loyalty. She had never felt a need to pick a weapon. Hers was always Cortana. But she liked to be at least competent in everything, so she'd sparred with Livy more than once.
I missed you, Livy crooned to the saber. I love you so much.
That was heartfelt, Emma said. If you'd said that to me when we got back, I would have cried.
Livy abandoned the saber and bounced over toward them. She commandeered a mat and began to stretch her muscles. She could fold herself easily in half, tucking her fingers under her toes.
I did miss you, she said, voice muffled. It was boring in England. There were no cute boys.
Julian said there were no humans for miles, said Emma.
Anyway, it's not like you missed anything here.
Well, aside from the serial killings, Livy said, moving across the room to take up two throwing knives. Emma and Christina moved out of the way as she lined herself up across from the target.
And I bet you dated Cameron Ashdown again, then dumped him.
She did, said Christina.
Emma shot her a look that said traitor.
Ha!
Livy's knife went wide of the target. She turned around, her braid bouncing on her shoulders. Emma goes out with him like every 4 months, then dumps him.
Oh?
Christina cut a glance toward Emma.
Why has he been singled out for this special torture?
Oh, for goodness sake, Emma said. It wasn't serious.
Not to you, said Livy.
But it was to him. She held out her second knife to Christina. Want to try? Christina took the knife and moved into Livy's position.
Who's Perfect Diego? Livy asked.
Christina had been frowning at the knife. Now she turned around and gaped at Livy.
I heard you, Livy said cheerfully, before I came in.
Who is he?
Why is he so perfect? Why is there a perfect boy in the world and no one's told me?
Diego is the boy Christina's mother wants her to marry, Emma told Livy. Now it was Christina's turn to look betrayed.
It's not an arranged marriage. That would be gross. It's just that her mother loves him. His mother carried the Rosales name.
He's related to you? Livy asked Christina. Isn't that a problem? I mean, I know Clary Fairchild and Jace Herondale are a famous love story, but they weren't actually brother and sister. Otherwise, I think it probably would be a less famous love story, said Emma with a grin.
Christina threw her knife. It hit close to the target's center.
His full name is Diego Rocio Rosales. Rocio is his father's last name, and Rosales his mother's, just like my mother's last name is Rosales. But that doesn't mean we're even cousins. The Rosaleses are a huge shadow-hunting family. My mother just thinks he's perfect.
So handsome, so smart, such a shadow hunter. Perfect, perfect, perfect.
And now you know how he got his nickname, said Emma, going to retrieve the knives from the wall.
Is he perfect? Livy asked.
No, Christina said. When Christina was upset, she didn't get angry. She just stopped talking. She was doing that now, staring at the target painted on the wall. Emma spun the knives she'd retrieved in her hands.
We'll protect you from Perfect Diego, Emma said. If he comes here, I'll impale him.
She moved toward the throwing line.
Emma's a master of the impalement arts, Livy said.
You'd be better off impaling my mother, Christina muttered.
All right, Flaquita, impress me. Let's see you throw two at a time.
A knife in each hand, Emma took a step back from the throwing line. She had taught herself to throw two knives at once over the course of a year, throwing again and again, the sound of the blades splitting the wood a balm to shattered nerves. She was left-handed,
so normally would have taken a step back and to the right, but she'd forced herself to be nearly ambidextrous. Her step back was direct, not diagonal. Her arms went back and then forward. She opened her hands, and the knives flew like falcons whose jesses had been cut. They soared toward the target and thudded, one after the other, into its heart. Christina whistled.
I see why Cameron Ashton keeps coming back. He's afraid not to.
She went to retrieve the knives, including her own.
Now I'm going to try again. I see that I am far behind where I should be.
Emma laughed.
No, I was cheating. I practiced that move for years.
Still, Christina said, if you ever change your mind and decide you don't like me, I better be able to defend myself.
Good throw, Livy said in a whisper coming up behind Emma as Christina, several feet away, paced back and forth at the throwing line.
Thanks, Emma whispered back.
Leaning against a rack of gloves and protective gear, she glanced down into Livy's sunny face.
Did you get anywhere with Ty?
And the parabatai thing?
She inquired, almost dreading the answer.
Livy's face clouded.
He still says no. It's the only thing we've ever disagreed about.
I'm sorry.
Emma knew how badly Livy wanted to be parabatai with her twin. Brothers and sisters who became parabatai were unusual but not unheard of. Ty's stark refusal was surprising, though. He rarely said no to Livy about anything, but he was obdurate about this.
Christina's blade slammed home, just at the rim of the target's inside circle. Emma cheered.
I like her, Livy said, still in a whisper.
Good, Emma said. I like her, too.
And I think perfect Diego maybe broke her heart.
He did something, Emma said guardedly.
That much I've guessed.
So I think we should set her up with Julian. Emma almost overturned the rack.
What?
Livy shrugged.
She's pretty, and she seems really nice. She's going to be living with us. And Jules hasn't ever had a girlfriend. You know why.
Emma just stared. Her head seemed full of white noise.
I mean, it's our fault. Mine and Ty's, and Drew's and Tabby's. Raising four kids, you don't exactly have a lot of time to date, so since we sort of took having a girlfriend away from him...
You want to set him up, Emma said blankly. I mean, it doesn't work like that, Livy. They'd have to like each other.
I think they could, said Livy, if we gave them a chance.
What do you say?
Her blue-green eyes, so much like Julian's, were full of affectionate mischief. Emma opened her mouth to say something. She didn't know what, when Christina let her second knife go. It slammed into the wall so hard that the wood seemed to crack.
Livy clapped her hands.
Awesome! She shot Emma a triumphant look as if to say, see, she's perfect. She glanced at her watch.
Okay, I have to go help Ty some more. Yell for me if anything awesomely exciting happens.
Emma nodded, a little stunned, as Livy danced away to hang up her weapons and head for the library. She was nearly startled out of her skin when a voice spoke from just over her shoulder. Christina had come up behind her and was looking worried.
What are you two talking about? She asked.
You look like you've seen a ghost.
Emma opened her mouth to say something but never found out what, because at that moment a commotion burst out from downstairs. She could hear the sound of someone pounding on the front door, followed by running feet. Catching up Cortana, Emma was out the door in a flash. The pounding on the front door of the Institute echoed through the building.
Just a minute! Julian yelled, zipping up his hoodie as he jogged toward the door.
He was almost glad someone had shown up. Ty and Livy had ordered him out of the computer room with the announcement that Julian was wrecking their concentration by pacing, and he'd been bored enough to consider going to check on Arthur, which he was fairly sure would put him in a bad mood for the rest of the day. Julian swung the door open. A tall, pale-haired man lounged on the other side, wearing tight black pants and a shirt unbuttoned halfway down his chest. A plaid jacket hung from his shoulders.
You look like a stripogram, Julian said to Malcolm Fade, High Warlock of Los Angeles.
There had been a time when Julian had been so impressed by the fact that Malcolm was High Warlock, the warlock to whom all other warlocks answered, at least in Southern California, that he'd been nervous around him. That had passed after the Dark War, when visits from Malcolm had become commonplace. Malcolm was in reality what most people thought Arthur was, an absent-minded professor type. He'd been forgetting important things for almost 200 years. All warlocks, being the offspring of human beings and demons, were immortal. They stopped aging at different points in their lives, depending on their demon parents. Malcolm looked as if he had stopped aging at about 27, but he had been, he claimed, born in 1850. Since most of the demons Julian had ever seen had been disgusting,
He didn't like to think too much about how Malcolm's parents had met. Malcolm didn't seem inclined to share either. Julian knew he'd been born in England, and he still had traces of the accent.
You can mail someone a stripper. Malcolm looked bemused and glanced down at himself. Sorry, I forgot to button my shirt before I left the house. He took a step inside the Institute and instantly fell over, sprawling lengthwise on the tiles. Julian moved aside and Malcolm rolled onto his back, looking disgruntled. He peered down his long body. I seem to have also tied my shoelaces together. Sometimes it was hard not to feel bitter, Julian reflected, that all the allies and friends in his life were either people he had to lie to, ridiculous, or both. Emma came rushing down the staircase, Cortana in her hand. She was wearing jeans and a tank top, her damp hair pulled back in an elastic band. The tank top was sticking to her skin, which Julian wished she hadn't noticed. She slowed down as she approached, relaxing. Hey, Malcolm.
Why are you on the floor?
I tied my shoelaces together, he said.
Emma had reached his side. She brought Cortana down neatly, severing Malcolm's shoelaces in half and freeing up his feet.
There you go, she said.
Malcolm looked warily at her.
She may be dangerous, he said to Julian.
Then again, all women are dangerous.
All people are dangerous, said Julian.
Why are you here, Malcolm? Not that I'm not pleased to see you.
Malcolm staggered to his feet, buttoning his shirt.
I brought Arthur's medicine.
Julian's heart thumped so loudly he was sure he could hear it. Emma frowned.
Has Arthur not been feeling well? She asked.
Malcolm, who had been reaching into his pocket, froze. Julian saw the realization dawn on his face that he'd said something he shouldn't, and he silently cursed Malcolm and his forgetfulness 1,000 times.
Arthur told me last night he'd been under the weather, Julian said. Just the usual stuff bothering him. It's chronic. Anyway, he was feeling low on energy.
I would have looked for something at the shadow market if I'd known, Emma said, sitting down on the bottom step of the staircase and stretching out her long legs.
Cayenne pepper and dragon's blood, said Malcolm, retrieving a vial from his pocket and proffering it to Julian.
Should wake him right up.
That would wake the dead up, said Emma.
Necromancy is illegal, Emma Carr says, scolded Malcolm.
She was just joking. Julian pocketed the vial, keeping his gaze fixed on Malcolm, silently begging him not to say anything.
When did you have a chance to tell Malcolm that your uncle wasn't feeling well, Jules? I saw you last night, and you didn't say anything, Emma said.
Julian was glad he was facing away from Emma. He was sure he'd gone white.
Vampire pizza, Malcolm said.
What? Emma said.
Nightshades opened up an Italian place on Cross Creek Road, Malcolm said. Best pizza for miles, and they deliver.
Don't you worry about what's in the sauce? Emma asked, clearly diverted.
Oh, her hand flew to her mouth. That reminds me, Malcolm, I was wondering if there was something you'd look at.
Is it a wart? Said Malcolm. I can cure that, but it'll cost you.
Why does everyone always think it's a wart?
Emma pulled her phone out and in a few seconds was showing him the photos of the body she'd found at the sepulchre bar.
There were these white markings here and here, she said, pointing. They look like graffiti, not paint, but chalk or something like that.
First, gross, Malcolm said. Please don't show me pictures of dead bodies without a warning.
He peered closer.
Second, those look like remnants of a ceremonial circle. Someone drew a protective ring on the ground, maybe to protect themselves while they were casting whatever nasty spell killed this guy.
He was burned, Emma said, and drowned, I think. At least his clothes were wet and he smelled like salt water.
She was frowning, her eyes dark. It could have been the memory of the body or just the thought of the ocean. It was an ocean she lived across from, ran beside every day, but Julian knew how much it terrified her. She could force herself into it, sick and shaking, but he hated watching her do it, hated watching his strong Emma torn to shreds by the terror of something so primal and nameless she couldn't explain it even to herself. It made him want to kill things, destroy things to keep her safe, even though she could keep herself safe, even though she was the bravest person he knew.
Julian snapped back to the present.
Forward me the photos, Malcolm was saying. I'll look them over more closely and let you know.
Hey! Livy appeared at the top of the stairs, having changed out of her training gear. Ty found something about the killings.
Malcolm looked puzzled.
On the computer, Livy elaborated. You know, the one we're not supposed to have.
Oh, hi, Malcolm, she waved vigorously. You guys should come upstairs.
Would you stay, Malcolm? Emma asked, scrambling to her feet. We could use your help.
That depends, Malcolm said. Does the computer play movies?
It can play movies, said Julian cautiously.
Malcolm looked pleased.
Can we watch Notting Hill?
We can watch anything if you're willing to help, Emma said. She glanced at Jules. And we can find out what Ty discovered. You're coming, right?
Silently, Julian cursed Malcolm's love of romantic movies. He wished he could head to his studio and paint, but couldn't exactly avoid Ty or abandon Malcolm.
I can get snacks from the kitchen, Emma said, sounding hopeful.
After all, for years it had been their habit to watch old movies on their witchlight-powered TV, eating popcorn by the flickering illumination.
Julian shook his head. I'm not hungry.
He almost thought he could hear Emma sigh. A moment later, she disappeared after Livy up the stairs. Julian made as if to follow them, but Malcolm stopped him with a hand on his shoulder.
It's gotten worse, hasn't it? He said.
Uncle Arthur?
Jules was caught off guard.
I don't think so. I mean, it's not great that I haven't been here, but
if we'd kept refusing to go to England, someone would have gotten suspicious.
Not Arthur, said Malcolm. You.
Does she know about you?
Does who know what?
Don't be dense, Malcolm said. Emma, does she know?
Julian felt his heart wrench inside his chest. He had no words for the feeling of upheaval Malcolm's words caused. It was too much like being tumbled by a wave, solid footing giving way in the slide of sand.
Stop.
I won't, Malcolm said. I like happy endings.
Julian spoke through his teeth.
Malcolm, this is not a love story.
Every story is a love story.
Julian drew away from him and started toward the stairs. He was rarely actually angry at Malcolm, but right now his heart was pounding. He made it to the landing before Malcolm called after him. He turned, knowing he shouldn't, and found the warlock looking up at him.
Laws are meaningless, child, Malcolm said in a low voice that somehow still carried. There is nothing more important than love, and no law higher.
Technically, the Institute wasn't supposed to have a computer in it. The Clave resisted the advent of modernity, but even more so any engagement with mundane culture. But that had never stopped Tiberius. He'd started asking for a computer at the age of 10 so that he could keep up to date on violent mundane crimes, and when they'd come back from Idris after the Dark War, Julian had given him one. Ty had lost his mother and father, his brother and his older sister, Jules had said at the time, sitting on the floor amid a tangle of wires, trying to figure out how to plug the computer into one of the few electrical outlets they had. Almost everything in the Institute ran on witchlight. If he could give this to Ty, at least it would be something. And indeed, Ty loved the computer. He named it Watson and spent hours teaching himself how to use it, since no one else had a clue. Julian told him not to do anything illegal. Arthur, locked away in his study, didn't notice. Livy, ever dedicated to her sibling, had also taught herself to use it, with Ty's help, once he'd familiarized himself with how it worked. Together, they were a formidable team. It looked like Ty, Drew, Livy, and even Tavi had been busy. Drew had spread maps all over the floor. Tavi was standing by a whiteboard with a blue dry erase marker, making possibly helpful notations if they could ever be translated out of 7-year-old. Ty was seated at the swivel chair in front of the computer, his fingers moving swiftly over the keyboard. Livy was perched on the desk, as she often was. Ty worked around her, completely aware of where she was while at the same time focusing on the task at hand.
So you found something? Julian said as they came in.
Yes, just a second. Ty held up his hand imperiously. You can talk to each other if you like.
Julian grinned.
That's very kind. Christina came hurrying in, braiding her damp dark hair. She'd clearly showered and redressed in jeans and a flowered blouse.
Livy told me.
Shh. Emma put her fingers to her lips and indicated Ty, staring intently at the computer's blue screen. It lit up his delicate features. She loved the moments when Ty was playing detective. He so clearly fell into the part, into the dream of being Sherlock Holmes, who always had all the answers. Christina nodded and sat down on the overstuffed love seat beside Drusilla. Drew was nearly as tall as she was, despite being only 13. She was one of those girls whose body had grown up quickly. She had breasts and hips, was soft and curvy. It had led to some awkward moments with boys who thought she was 17 or 18 years old,
and a few incidents where Emma had barely stopped Julian from murdering a mundane teenager. Malcolm settled himself in a patched armchair.
"Well, if we're waiting," he said and began typing on his phone.
"What are you doing?" Emma asked.
"Ordering pizza from Nightshades," said Malcolm. "There's an app."
"A what?" said Drew.
"Nightshade?" Livy turned around. "The vampire?"
"He owns a pizza place. The sauce is divine," Malcolm said, kissing his fingers.
"Aren't you worried what's in it?" said Livy.
"You Nephilim are so paranoid," said Malcolm, returning to his phone. Ty cleared his throat, spinning his chair back around to face the room. Everyone had settled themselves on couches or chairs except Tavi, who was sitting on the floor under the whiteboard. "I found some stuff," he said. "There definitely have been bodies that fit Emma's description. Fingerprints sanded off, soaked in seawater, skin burned." He pulled up the front page of a newspaper on screen. "Mundanes think it's satanic cult activity because of the chalk markings found around the bodies."
"Mundanes think everything is satanic cult activity," said Malcolm. "Most cults are actually in service of completely different demons than Lucifer. He's quite famous and very hard to reach. Rarely does favors for anyone. Really an unrewarding demon to worship."
Emma and Julian exchanged looks of amusement. Ty clicked the computer mouse and pictures flashed up on the screen. Faces, different ages, races, genders, all of them slack in death.
"There are only a few murders that match the profile," said Ty. He seemed pleased to be using the word profile.
"There's been one every month for the past year, 12 counting the one Emma found, like she said."
Emma said, "But nothing before a year ago?" Ty shook his head.
"So there was a gap of 4 years since my parents were killed. Whoever it was, if it was the same person, stopped and started up again."
"Is there anything that links all these people?" Julian asked. "Diana said some of the bodies were Fae."
"Well, this is all mundane news," said Livy. "They wouldn't know, would they? They think the bodies were human if they were gentry Fae. As for anything linking them, none of them have been identified."
"That's weird," said Drew. "What about blood? In movies, they can identify people using blood and DTR.
DNA, corrected Ty. "Well, according to the newspapers, none of the bodies were identified. It could have been that whatever spells were done on them altered their blood. Or they could have decayed fast, like Emma's parents did. That would have limited what the coroners could have found out."
"There's something else, though," Livy said. "The stories all reported where the bodies were found, and we mapped them. They have one thing in common."
Ty had taken one of his hand toys out of his pocket, a mass of intermingled pipe cleaners, and was untangling it. Ty had one of the fastest working minds of anyone Emma knew, and it calmed him to have a way to use his hands to diffuse some of that quickness and intensity. "The bodies have all been dumped at ley lines. All of them," he said, and Emma could hear the excitement in his voice.
"Ley lines?"
Drew furrowed her brow.
"There's a network circling the world of ancient magical pathways," said Malcolm. "They amplify magic. So, for centuries, downworlders have used them to create entrances into faerie, that sort of thing. Alicante is built on a convergence of ley lines. They're invisible, but some can train themselves to sense them."
He frowned, staring at the computer screen where one of the images Christina had taken of the dead body at the sepulchre was displayed.
"Can you do that thing?" he said, "you know, where you make the picture bigger."
"You mean zoom in?" said Ty. Before Malcolm could answer, the doorbell of the Institute rang. It was no ordinary shrilling doorbell. It sounded like a gong being struck through the building, shivering the glass and stone and plaster. Emma was up and on her feet in a second. "I'll get it," she said, and hurried downstairs, even as Julian half rose from his seat to follow her.
But she wanted to be alone just for a second. Wanted to process the fact that these killings dated back to the year of her parents' death. They had started then. Her father and mother had been the first. These murders were connected. She could see the threads coming together, forming a pattern she could only begin to glimpse but knew was real. Someone had done these things. Someone had tortured and killed her parents, had carved evil markings on their skin and dumped them in the ocean to rot. Someone had taken Emma's childhood, torn away the roof and walls of the house of her life, leaving her cold and exposed. And that someone would pay. "Revenge is a cold bedfellow," Diana had said, but Emma didn't believe that. Revenge would give her the air back in her lungs. Revenge would let her think about her parents without a cold knot forming in her stomach. She would be able to dream without seeing their drowned faces and hearing their voices cry out for her help. She reached the front door of the Institute and threw it open. The sun had just set. A glum vampire stood in the doorway carrying several stacked boxes. He looked like a teenager with short brown hair and freckled skin, but that didn't mean much.
"Pizza delivery," he said in a tone that suggested that most of his closest relatives had just died.
"Seriously?" Emma said. "Malcolm wasn't making that up. You really deliver pizza?"
He looked at her blankly. "Why wouldn't I deliver pizza?" Emma fumbled at the small table near the door for the cash they usually kept there. "I don't know. You're a vampire. I figured you'd have something better to do with your life, your unlife, whatever." The vampire looked aggrieved. "You know how hard it is to get a job when your ID says you're 150 years old and you can only go out at night?" "No," Emma admitted, taking the boxes. "I hadn't considered that. Nephilim never do." As he tucked a 50 into his jeans, Emma noticed that he was wearing a gray t-shirt that said TMI across the front. "Too much information?" she said. He brightened. "The Mortal Instruments, they're a band from Brooklyn. You heard of them?" Emma had. Clary's best friend and parabatai, Simon, had belonged to them when he was a mundane. That was how they'd wound up named after the three most holy objects in the Shadowhunter world. Now Simon, too, was a Shadowhunter. She wondered how he felt about the band going on without him, about everything going on without him. She made her way back up the stairs, her mind on Clary and the others in the New York Institute. Clary had found out she was a shadow hunter when she was 15 years old. There had been a time when she thought she'd lead a mundane life. She talked about it before, around Emma, the way anyone might talk about a road not taken. She'd carried a lot with her into her shadow hunter life, including her best friend, Simon. But she could have chosen differently. She could have been a mundane. Emma wanted to talk to her suddenly about what that might have meant. Simon had been Clary's best friend for her whole life, like Jules had been Emma's. Then they had been parabatai. Once Simon was a shadow hunter. What had changed? Emma wondered. What did it feel like to go from best friend to parabatai without having always known you were going to do it? How was it different? And why didn't she know the answer to that herself? When she arrived back in the computer room, Malcolm was standing near the desk, violet eyes snapping. "You see, it's not a protection circle at all," he was saying, and then broke off as Emma came in. "It's pizza!" "It can't be pizza," said Ty, staring perplexedly at the screen.
His long fingers had nearly untangled all the pipe cleaners. When he was done, he tangled them back up and start again. "All right, enough," said Jules. "We're taking a break from killings and profiles for dinner." He took the boxes from Emma, shooting her a grateful look, and set them down on the coffee table. "I don't care what you all want to talk about. It just can't involve murder or blood. Any blood."
"But it's vampire pizza," Livy pointed out.
"Immaterial," said Julian. "Couch, now."
"Can we watch a movie?" Malcolm piped up, sounding remarkably like Tavi.
"We can watch a movie," Julian said. "Now, Malcolm, I don't care if you're the high warlock of Los Angeles. Sit your butt down." The vampire pizza was shockingly good. Emma decided fairly quickly that she didn't care what was in the sauce. Mouse heads, stewed people parts, whatever. It was amazing. It had a crispy crust and just the right amount of fresh mozzarella. She sucked the cheese off her fingers and made faces at Jules, who had excellent table manners. The film was much more puzzling. It appeared to be about a man who owned a bookstore and was in love with a famous woman, except Emma recognized neither of them and wasn't sure if she was supposed to. Christina watched in large-eyed bafflement. Ty put his headphones on and closed his eyes, and Drew and Livy sat on either side of Malcolm, patting him gently while he wept.
"Love is beautiful," he said while the man on screen ran through traffic.
"That's not love," said Julian, leaning back against the couch. The flickering light from the screen played over his skin, making it seem unfamiliar, adding freckles of darkness to the smooth, pale places and lighting the shadows under his cheekbones at the hollow of his throat.
"That's movies."
"I came to Los Angeles to bring back love," Malcolm said, his dark violet eyes mournful. "All great movies are about love,
Love lost, found, destroyed, regained, bought, sold, dying and being born. I love movies, but they've forgotten what they're about. Explosions, effects, that wasn't what it meant when I first got here. It was about lighting cigarettes,